The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. My name is Charlie Clawson, and my guest this week is a journalist, critic, and a man about town, Guy Davis. Thank you for doing FOFOP. Welcome to the show.
Charlie, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
When I said man about town, I didn't mention that town is Geelong, but it still counts, right?
You can be a man about town simply by leaving your door and walking about two blocks in Geelong. That makes you a social gadfly, I think, down here.
Yeah, well, you could run for mayor on that and those kind of credentials, couldn't you?
Occasionally leaves the house, vote one Davis.
Now, Guy, I'm so excited to have you on the show because one of my absolute pleasures of an evening when I'm perusing Twitter is to see that Guy Davis has decided to settle in on the couch and rewatch an old movie. And we'll just get like, it's not sort of a live commentary, but you know, I think on average, I see about four or five tweets from you over the duration of a 2 hour film. And it makes me so happy because it harkens back to a time in which I was more of a cinephile, in which I used to love just sort of digging up an old film, comparing it to a remake, or just, you know, finding an obscure actor like a Wings Hauser. And let's explore his oeuvre.
Absolutely. Yes. Let's spread those wings. No, look, it's very sweet of you to say so, Charlie. I mean, you're right in that it's usually four or five tweets and then I'll either fall asleep on the couch or get so drawn into what I'm watching. It's like, well, why live tweet this when you can actually just enjoy it yourself? But you're right. It's usually older stuff that I find myself revisiting. I mean, and every once in a while it's like, should you really be dragging out John Carpenter's Ghosts of Mars again? I mean, how many times have you seen this? And it's not really going to get any better no matter how many times you watch it. There's a whole bunch of new stuff being released. Maybe check that out. Maybe, you know, expand your horizons a little bit. But no, it's invariably going back to the ones that you enjoy, the old faithfuls, the old reliables, isn't it?
So in this era of streaming, because this is what fascinates me, I think that when streaming came along, the advent of streaming has made me a lazier consumer of film. Like, I think when it's almost like, you know, the days of going into a record shop and holding the album and looking at the artwork. And there was a bunch of different selling points to the experience of, you know, selecting music. And I used to feel that was the same way with movies, you know, like before the internet, you know, I subscribed to Premiere magazine and you'd get wind of that was coming out. And, you know, that's where I learnt about kind of, you know, indie film directors in the 90s. Now, I sort of came of age with film in the 90s in the sort of indie revolution. Unfortunately, mostly spearheaded by Miramax. But you've got to admit, they knew how to encourage independent filmmakers. And so from that point, you know, I then worked in a video store. And that experience of walking past a section, and in the video store I walked in, which was, it wasn't a Blockbuster, it was a Movie Land, which is kind of a sort of lower tier franchise. We'd still, it wasn't the kind of Disney-ified Blockbuster video where it was only mainstream titles. They would occasionally have, like, I think they even had like Shocking Asia, like volumes one through five or whatever it was. And so that experience of walking through a video store and catching a cover, and it was generally in the horror section or the art house section where you're like, that's a fucked up cover. And then taking that home and plugging that into your VCR with no idea really what you're about to see. You seem to be having that experience now in streaming. How much work is that for you?
I'll tell you what, yeah, I mean, there's that term analysis paralysis where you're just inundated with so many options that you really just don't know which way to turn and you invariably sort of go to what you know. You may feel bold or daring some nights, going, well, I don't know anything about this, but no, it's got a name I can trust. Maybe it's going to be okay. I don't know what Netflix or Prime or Stan or any of those. Your disappointment rate is invariably pretty high.
Yeah. But it's more than that, though. I think it is, Like Amazon, for instance, Prime Video have actually quite a big collection of B movies.
You do. You have to dig pretty deep. But once you get in there, and the algorithm sort of takes over and says, oh, you're spending a bit of time looking at that Wings Hauser movie. Maybe you'd like this movie where the boa takes on the python. It's like, yes, I would.
Shout out to Wings Hauser. Did you reckon this? When was the last time he was mentioned twice in a podcast?
There was a little flurry on film Twitter, such as it is, not long ago when there was one of those brief announcements like, Wings Hauser has died at the age of... What? Oh. No. And luckily, Wings's people, if he has people, got in touch and said, no, Wings still very much with us. Like, oh, the star of Vice Squad and lives to, you know, abuse and castigate another day. Hooray.
Now, you would know, is the actor Cole Hauser from Good Will Hunting, is that Wings Hauser's son?
That's his son. Wow. Yeah, yeah. And I was always a huge fan of Wings Hauser. He's mentioned in, he co-stars in one of your films. I hate to sort of take you behind the curtain, folks, but
we have discussed this before recording.
This is not all ad lib. Charlie and I actually sort of presented each other with a list of films that we're going to talk about. But I sort of dug him from day one. It's like, who's this guy? He's interesting. You know, he's not really trying to dominate the scene so much, although there's something about him. He's quite charismatic.
He had a bad guy face. You know what I mean? Like, but he was handsome. It's almost not dissimilar to Michael Shannon in the way that Michael Shannon, on your first sighting, he's like, whoa, like he looks like an Easter Island statue or something, but is so charismatic. Like my wife has watched Nine Perfect Strangers, which I haven't seen. I've heard mixed reviews, but she was talking about him in that as this like, you know, he's a likable leading man, like sort of almost in that sort of Hanks territory. And I'm like, Michael Shannon isn't like that. Every time you see Michael Shannon, he's always a weirdo. But then I thought about it, it's like, but he can do anything. And I could totally buy him as like, oh, I'm playing every man now.
He really can. There's a terrific movie called Midnight Special. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard of that
one. Yeah, I love Jeff Nichols films.
Yeah, Jeff Nichols is a fantastic filmmaker. And this was kind of his stab at going mainstream. And unfortunately, I don't think it did all that well. I don't think it made a whole heap of money. But it's very much like a mid-career John Carpenter movie, sort of like a road movie with sci-fi. Yeah, it really is Starman.
Yeah.
And Shannon's playing this very loving, soft-spoken father. And there's a scene near the end with his son that is just one of the best evocations of parental love, fatherly love that I've ever seen on screen. And Shannon just plays it so beautifully. So... And he's the last person you'd kind of expect that from because he's...
He looks like
very tall, very domineering, and he looks like he'd just shank you if you looked at him sideways.
You know,
I'm very, very partial to actors like that who look one way but have the capability to surprise you.
Yeah, it's that thing, isn't it, about like there's certain casting when we were sort of compiling our lists. Dennis Hopper was popping up a lot in the films that I was like looking at. And in the 90s, especially after Speed, it was like Waterworld. And it was like they would cast him when you needed your go-to villain for your mid-range budget action movie. You know, you couldn't afford like a top range, Alan Rickman or whatever. So you get Dennis Hopper. And I'm always like, that is the laziest casting. Oh, we need a crazy bad guy. Get Dennis Hopper. Mm. It's like when you cast Christopher Walken as a crazy, like, yeah, he... Of course, like that's the obvious thing.
You would, of course. Yeah, I mean, why would you not have Christopher Walken in your movie, but give him something better to do than
or just cast against type, like, you know, have him be the romantic lead. Like, that's why I think everyone's minds were blown with that Weapon of Choice music video.
That's right, yeah, because not many people are aware that he was a professional dancer.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, talking about Dennis Hopper and Christopher Walken, I mean, you've got one of the great sort of face-offs in recent cinema history in True Romance where, you know, Walken's playing the bad guy, but he's not necessarily hamming it up or going full metal Walken the way he normally does. He's clearly venomous and threatening, but Dennis Hopper at the same time is this very likable father who's knows he's doomed and he's trying to speed up the process so they don't torture him too much. So he's insulting Christopher Walken's heritage, all this kind of stuff, in very, very, very politically incorrect language. But it's, just a terrific scene between those two and great casting against type for Hopper as well.
Yeah, you're right. I never actually thought about that. But that was right in that, you know, Dennis Hopper's kind of renaissance as a villain in big, in, you know, tentpole films. Tony Scott cast him as like a lovable, cuddly dad. That's great. That's great casting against type.
But Hopper had that great 1-2 punch in about 86 or so, because everyone remembers Blue Velvet, where he's just absolutely terrifying. It's probably the most terrifying villain performance for mine that's ever been, certainly up there with the most terrifying villains have been ever put on screen. He's just so, there's no words for it, I'm sorry. But then at the same time, or the same year, I think he's in Hoosiers as well, that Gene Hackman basketball movie.
Yeah, right.
Playing this lovable town drunk who was a basketball champ, and Hackman says, look, I'll give you a chance to sort of redeem yourself by being the assistant coach. And Hopper's going, oh, yeah, I'd give Dennis Hopper a shot. Look at him. He's a little, bit, a little bit pathetic, but there's something in the eyes. Let's see what we can do with old Den here. So, but yeah, I'm glad he had that comeback. I mean, I'm a sucker for a good comeback story. Maybe it's why I'm a Tarantino fan, because he will, you know, occasionally cast big names in it. But even when he's casting big names, it's like, well, I'll cast John Travolta. It's like, really? You've got the world at your feet here, Quentin. You could cast anyone in your lead in Pulp Fiction. Goes, no, I think John Travolta could do really well here. People watch it. Oh, my God, we'd love John Travolta, don't we? This reminds us of that. You know, did the same with Robert Forster and Jackie Brown, which is one of my favorite comeback stories for an actor of all time. Or he discovers people like Christoph Waltz. That's, I don't know.
He knows how to revive a career. And it's funny, anyone who listens to TOEFOP knows that my favorite actor of all time is Michael Keaton. I've always loved Michael Keaton. And when he had his real dry spell, you know, kind of in the 90s after Batman, really, you know, and I remember he got cast in Jackie Brown and I was like, yes, like Tarantino sees it, And he's not really like, Ray Nicolette is a cool character, but he's not the star. Like, he needed his own spin-off, but it never happened. And I remember kind of, as we got further into the 2000s, I was holding a torch for Michael Keaton. I remember, like, especially when I was doing, when I got the Home and Away and all these kids, like, you know, they think Nicolas Cage is a terrible actor because they've come of age when he was doing all those direct-to-video stuff. And so then you bring up Michael Keaton and they're like, oh, that skinny Batman, you know, Mr. Mom, you know, they're really reaching. You're like, no, he's really good. So then when Birdman happened, I felt the most vindication I'd ever have, because suddenly I see Michael Keaton on talk shows and he's on Saturday Night Live and the cast of Saturday Night Live are telling how much they love Michael Keaton. There's literally, they have a sketch where it's just the male cast members saying how much they love Michael Keaton. And I was shouting from the rooftops, I always said this. I knew he was a star.
There's that great thing with Ray Nicolette as well, where he's got the part in Jackie Brown, but he's also playing Ray Nicolette in Out of Sight.
Out of Sight. It's a great cameo.
And that whole scene with him and Dennis Farina is just so marvelous. It's one of the best exchanges where he's, I think Ray Nicolette's wearing a T-shirt that says FBI or something like that. And Farina says, do you ever wear one that says undercover? And Keaton's just looking at him like, is this guy taking the piss?
He doesn't get it.
But at the same time... He's my girlfriend's dad. I don't want to get on the wrong side of him. Keaton's just doing all this without saying a word, and then just says, no.
Yeah. it's brilliant. All right, well, let's get into why I got you on the show. So I texted Guy and I said, look, I want you to come on the show and I want to talk about films. And I want to sort of take it back to an era of, you know, the video store. I used to work in a video store and, like I said, I love that experience of going down the aisle and just grabbing films. And I found when I was working in the video store, there were certain films that if I was on my way out the door and I wanted a comfort movie, or even if I was working, there's certain films that I would throw on again and again and again. So these aren't necessarily the award winners. They're not necessarily like the greatest films of all time, but they're the films that Guy and I, if you went into a video store, if we went to a video store, this would ordinarily top up our, you know, $5 for $10 deal weekly hire. So I'll let you kick things off. What is your first film from the video store?
Well, my first film is, it's gone by a couple of titles, but in Australia back in the day, back in the early 80s, because we're going way back into time here, it was called Angel of Vengeance, but it started life as a movie called Ms. 45, and it's directed by a guy named Abel Ferrara. Abel's an interesting cat, very much an independent spirit kind of guy. Don't think he's worked in the studio system once or twice. I think he directed, if not the pilot for Miami Vice, then certainly a few episodes of that. He's worked with Michael Mann a bit, but primarily he's known for working outside the studio system and being very much his own man. This is not his debut feature, but it might be his second or third. You know, he did a bit of everything. I mean, he's very much a New York scene kind of guy, worked in that new wave vein. I think he directed porno before he actually went legit.
He's got an edge. He's got an edge to his stuff.
He certainly has an edge. And this is not this is not the first time you will hear the name Abel Ferrara. This is we're going to start with Abel and end with Abel.
He also directed a Michael Keaton film, Desperate Measures, with Andy Garcia.
Did he direct that one?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure was Abel Ferrara. Yeah, because I remember Desperate Measures is one of those kind of late '90s kind of like. It feels like a knockoff of like five different other films. It's kind of Hannibal Lecter.
Even the title. It kind of feels like.
Yeah, everything about it is just like cheesy.
And and you've got two stars who are reputable and, Andy Garcia, he has rarely steered me wrong, but they're not quite at the peak of their stardom.
No, right at the tail end of their stardom. the start of the end.
Yeah.
So I couldn't find any trailer for Angel of Vengeance online, but I did look it up. So this is a revenge film. It's in the tradition of I Spit on Your Grave, right?
Very much. Yeah, it's a rape revenge movie. And really, I shouldn't have been watching this at age 11, which is when I saw it. But I think if you talk to many film nerds, they will name check a book called Cult Movies. There are actually three in the series written by a guy called Danny Peary. And I think he started writing them in the 70s and 80s. And, pre-internet, it was hard to find material about movies that weren't necessarily classics but had a good reputation among certain people. And I devoured these books. I absolutely love them. And he did a really good essay on Angel of Vengeance, aka Miss 45. This sounds good. Now, at this time, I should tell you a bit about how my video store sort of connection. I'm from Geelong, as you mentioned. My dad was a footballer and a coach for the Geelong Football Club, and then he became a bit of a media personality post-footy career. And dad was a bit of a savvy operator when it came to leveraging his profile, particularly in a small town like Geelong. He would occasionally sort of not accost local businesses, but, he would get in touch with people and say, if you'd like me to mention your video store on 3GL, the home of local football, maybe we could do a bit of a contra deal. That's how I became very well known at Vivid Video opposite Gardenia Park down here in Geelong, because I don't think the guy who ran the place knew that that Bob Davis had this budding film nerd son who would come down every few days and say, can I borrow three or four movies, please? Also, this guy behind the counter, Peter, very nice fella, was a bit he was a bit remiss in his duties. I don't think he'd have a good working with children qualification, because he was just letting me borrow.
Classifications were just like whatever. His basic instinct, kid, have fun.
So, of course, here's this kid who can barely see over the counter borrowing a rape revenge movie called Angel of Vengeance.
Wow.
The gist of it is there's this mute young woman working in the garment district in New York, sexually assaulted twice in one day.
Oh, God.
It's not necessarily graphic, but it's very confronting.
Mm.
The second rapist, she brains with an iron, kills him, takes his 45, and then heads out on the streets of New York to basically blow away anyone who looks at her twice and comes onto her in a sleazy fashion. Being New York in the 80s, there are plenty of people doing this. For some reason, this I won't say it's necessarily go-to, although I do own a copy of Miss 45 now. Yeah, but it's just one of those movies where it's like, wow, these are available? Because prior to this, you're used to watch movies in the cinema or you'd see whatever was on TV and that was what you got. Then they start opening video stores. It's like, oh, wow, so it's like a library, but not books, it's movies. I can go and take this out, take it for a couple of days, bring it back. And there's of this wide range of stuff that just expanding all the time because there was just so much money to be made.
Mm.
Yeah, so Angel of Vengeance was one of my first experiences with that, along with, things like Star Wars and, the classics that you would initially go to see seven times at the cinema. It's now I can just bring it home and watch it.
Yeah, it's funny too how many kind of legit directors start in that exploitation kind of area. Even like Wes Craven's, like Wes Craven made virtually a porno. Then he made like Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes. And then he sort of worked his way up. And every interview you see with Wes Craven and people have described him as like, he's like a college professor. Like he's this academic. And it seems so contradictory to have such a kind of well-spoken, intelligent man then make this really confronting, you know, rape revenge stories. But they're obviously exercising really something like as a part of their process of becoming like, in inverted commas, legitimate directors.
Very much so. I mean, yeah, you think of horror directors, you maybe think of someone like Rob Zombie, you know, someone actually with the dreads and the black t-shirt and the black wardrobe and all that kind of stuff. And then you see, interviews with someone like Craven, who, as you said, very soft-spoken, very mild-mannered, got that college professor demeanor. Likewise with David Cronenberg, who, you know, this king of body horror, who just has this lovely, calm, soothing voice. He sounds like your therapist.
Yeah. Yeah,
so clearly they're the one exception to that rule
is David Lynch, who does not have a calming voice. If you've ever seen that video of him complaining about the budget for the Twin Peaks reboot, it's so funny. I can't fucking do this.
but even with that sort of Jimmy Stewart voice, it's hard to not. You take him seriously, of course, but at the same time, it's like, oh wow, you're this sweet-natured Midwestern guy who occasionally flies off the handle a bit, but mostly I think Mel Brooks was the one who described him as like Jimmy Stewart from Mars.
Well, my first pick is a bit of a bit of a departure for yours in terms of genre and tone. And I thought a lot about this because I sort of, in the 90s, it was kind of when the SNL expanded sketch film was king, you know, that's when, if it wasn't the expanded sketch, you know, like Coneheads or something, it was a vanity project, you know, there's Adam Sandler, obviously, with like Billy Madison. And so these films are coming out all the time. And I even saw like A Night at the Roxbury and they're all fine. And I enjoyed watching them and, you know, my friends could quote them and all that kind of stuff. But then Norm Macdonald, rest in peace, makes a film called Dirty Work, which is kind of his post-SNL leveraging off that sort of SNL fame, bringing in some cameos from some SNL performers, attempt at this vanity project. But like everything Norm Macdonald does, it feels like
there's not a speck of vanity in it.
No, there's no vanity. And it feels like it's almost like a deconstruction of what these vanity projects are like. Like he has it's the most kind of grafted on plot where, you know, he has to, the premise is that he and his friend set up a revenge business. They need to like get their grandpa out of a nursing home or their father into a nursing home or something to do with a nursing home. Who cares? It doesn't matter. And there's a love interest. But it's just an excuse for Norm Macdonald to just do his anti-humor sketches the whole way through, to the point where the end of the film, and it must have been a studio note where they're like, we want a happy ending. We want him driving off in the sunset where he gets the girl. Mm. He gives a voiceover about paying off, you know, whoever was in trouble that he raised money for, but the mob kills him anyway. Anyway, he's dead now. Bye. And that's how the film ends. And it was just such a, I mean, I loved Norm Macdonald, but just sort of seeing, this is what you can do with it. Like someone gave him millions of dollars to make this film, which is basically just a complete deconstruction of those Saturday Night Live vanity projects.
Absolutely. And as you said, mentioned, he's got the love interest, but she's so sort of perfunctory.
Yeah.
I don't think I can't remember the actor's name.
No. It also contains one of my favorite Norm Macdonald's bits, which is where he gets sent to prison and he is assaulted in jail and he comes out to tell off a room of prisoners like a disappointed parent. It's just ridiculous. I mean, there was no reason for that. They were uncalled for, just ridiculous.
He's not traumatized. He's just nonplussed. Like, ridiculous.
And also probably one of my favorite Chris Farley performances. It was actually a line ball between Dirty Work and Tommy Boy because I loved Chris Farley and I just think Tommy Boy is such a joyous film. But I think that Dirty Work has my favorite Chris Farley performance as a vet with half his nose bitten off. It
just allowed Chris to go to town, didn't it? Just bellowing the way he did. Have you read the biography of him? I think it's called The Chris Farley Story.
Is that by the one that written by his brother?
I don't know if it was written by his brother, but I think his family certainly had a big say in it. I remember I bought it at an airport in LA and I read it on the flight back to Australia. And I think high altitudes do tend to have an effect on your mood, because God knows I've cried at so many movies on planes, and then you watch it another time. It's like, there is nothing sad or emotional about this. It must have been just air pressure. But I was reading the Chris Farley story and just absolutely weeping, because he just seemed like such a sweetheart.
Yeah.
But someone with no or little to no impulse control either.
Yeah. I mean, he has a strange kind of charisma. Like, you watch... life coach Matt Foley is one of my favorite SNL characters. And I can just watch GIFs of Chris Farley doing that dance, that strange dance. And it just, like, he's just charismatic. It's also that thing too of John Goodman has the same kind of thing where they're big guys, but they're also incredibly light on their feet and so good at comedy. Like, just their timing is perfect.
Mm. That sketch with him and Patrick Swayze is where they're auditioning for the Chippendales. It's just so incredible, because, you know, Farley's going for it 100%, but Swayze's just this lovely giving scene partner as well. You can tell they're both really pulling for each other. But Swayze's just in the best shape of his life, oiled up, tanned, and here's Farley, pale, no, flabby,
absolutely no
got
shame.
The coin slot out of the back of the shorts. But it's just 100% dancing like crazy. Oh, it's such a great thing. Sandler as well in Dirty Work gives a terrific little cameo
as Satan.
Well,
Gary Coleman precedes that flashback, I believe, or that.
Oh yeah, he's in it as well. Yeah,
that's right.
What are you talking about, Satan?
All right, Guy. What is your second selection from the video store?
My second selection, and I'm hoping that I'm not giving off the impression that I'm a complete deviant or pervert here. But my second film is a slasher movie called The Burning. Now, horror movies were really big when video stores started to kick off. I mean, if you're having your video night with your group of high school friends or whatever, there's always that air of forbidden fruit of, like, who can get the grossest horror movie. And Evil Dead is one that comes up a great deal. When I mentioned to my girlfriend last night that I was going to be on this podcast, we're going to be talking about sort of VHS memories. She said, "Are you going to be talking about Evil Dead?" And I'm like, "What do you know about Evil Dead? We've never watched that together, although maybe we should." But that was the one that tended to be brought out at a lot of parties like that.
Yeah.
But when we were in our teens back in the day, people knew that I was a bit of a movie nerd. They said, "Oh, Guy, can you bring over a horror movie?" I'm like, yeah, no worries. Here's one that I've heard is actually kind of interesting. It's a movie called The Burning. Now, the fact that one of the opening credits says, not written by, but created by Harvey Weinstein, this is the very early days of Miramax, should give you an indication of what you're in for here, because it's a slasher movie in the vein of your Friday the 13th, things like that. It's a summer camp. The old groundskeeper who was burned to a crisp, but still alive.
Cropsy.
By a prank by the kids a few years ago. He's out there stalking and slashing and just making life miserable for everybody. The violence in it isn't necessarily fun. It's like you're lingering a bit on these stab wounds and the TNA aspect of it, which was kind of a selling point back in the day, is like, oh, this is not just tea. This is full frontal nudity. And everyone's sort of looking at me like, Guy, what have you brought us? We were in for some, mildly spooky thrills, and you've basically brought us a snuff movie. Having said that, I find there's a lot to enjoy in it. It's got an early performance from Jason Alexander.
Yep. Holly Hunter. And
Holly Hunter has like a bit part in it. Like, you don't see her all that much, but Alexander is playing sort of a cross between David Addison from Moonlighting and Bluto Blutarski from Animal House. He's the fun guy. He's not necessarily the alpha male among the kids. And he, honest to God, looks like he's about 30 or so. And he's, I don't know if he's meant to be a counselor or a camper, but he's like, oh, there's something about this guy that's kind of interesting and fun. With a full head of hair, it's kind of interesting. But it's one that I enjoy because it really does go for it, but you have to be in a certain mood for it. And I don't know if the kids that I showed it to that particular night at this particular party were all that into it. It's like,
Well, this thing about slasher...
This one's for you, Guy.
The things about slasher films is it's about the kills, right? Like, that's what Friday the 13th really is, especially, you know, the thing that the thing that sort of differentiated, like people forget that the first Halloween is actually quite bloodless. Even though it kickstarted really the entire slasher genre, it was Friday the 13th that sort of brought in the idea of inventive kills.
Yeah.
And then that's what becomes a signature of it. It's like, you know, it's what's that? Is it the Strindberg's law? If there's a gun on stage, you better see it, you know. So,
oh, yeah.
So if you see a pitchfork or a combine harvester or something early in a slasher film, it's just the countdown till how's it. And that's the, you know, the fun of it, the dark fun of it. So are the burning, because it's Tom Savini, right? He was a special effects supervisor.
He was, yeah. Who also did effects for the original Friday the 13th and maybe also the final chapter of Friday the 13th, which of course was not the final chapter. Never but yeah, the real A number one of gross gore effects, and he goes to town in this one. I mean, there's fingers getting lopped off, there's necks getting, jugular veins getting severed, and scalps getting scalped. And like, well, Joe, just, I mean, sorry, Tom, just have at it, man. Do your thing. And he really, really does. But yeah, it's funny you mentioned Halloween, because really that's the movie that I should have brought to the party, because it's good and spooky. It's got characters you can relate to. It's got, oh, that's a bit of a scare. But yeah, it's not necessarily going to traumatize anyone. It's amazing that it was rated R back in the day.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because of all the horror, I was a real horror nut as a kid. And of all the horror films, that one being the most bloodless still has the most impact, because John Carpenter is so wonderful at composition and framing.
Yeah.
The imagery is far more haunting than, like, I think the first Nightmare on Elm Street comes close, but that's much more surreal and cartoonish and over the top.
Yeah.
But in terms of just that kind of creepy, it feels, you know, much more like elevated horror. It's really psychological. And I think that's what these, I haven't seen the new Halloween, but the first David Gordon Green Halloween, because it gets so confusing when you try and name them. I thought it was fine, but it didn't have the same level of, the camera doesn't do really anything in the first Halloween. It just shows you a lot of empty space, and occasionally you'll glimpse a white mask, and that's what makes it so fucking creepy.
Mm. Oh, it's really elegant.
Yes, elegant, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, I mean, just scenes of, I think it's little Tommy Doyle looking at his living room window. And you see the silhouette of Michael Myers across the road.
It's so creepy.
And if you saw that in real life, I mean, even as a middle-aged man, I'd be going, lock all the doors, draw the blinds.
I remember being a young, like 8 or 9 years old. There was a couple of Americans who lived on the street I grew up in, and they would organize trick-or-treating way before it became cool in Australia. And so I have a real clear memory of being 8 years old and out with everyone trick-or-treating, and the group sort of splintering off, and me being a kid going, I still want more lollies. So I kept going on my own. And I remember going up this long driveway, and all I could hear was that din, 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 because someone's watching Halloween. And I go up to the window and I see that shot of Jamie Lee Curtis. She thinks she's killed him, and you just see him sit up and turn his head. And like, I was just, and then I suddenly realized that I'm 8 years old, it's nighttime, I'm out on my own in the dark. And I just didn't even bother asking, like ringing the doorbell. I just bolted home. And I think because of that one
experience.
No more
candy for Charlie.
Yeah. It burnt into my brain. All right. Well,
tell me about your next one.
My next one is probably the most mainstream of all the films we're going to talk about. But this genuinely was a film that it was a slow day in the video store and I just wanted to put something on that had enough action that it could keep me entertained but wouldn't offend the customers. It was Die Hard with a Vengeance. Now, I never saw the original Die Hard at the cinemas, but like every teenage boy, probably every teenager, male or female or non-binary, it was the greatest action film of the late 80s, you know, like it just defined what action films were going to become then on. I thought Speed did a pretty good job in the 90s of like updating the premise of like, you know, man on bomb more danger on contained space.
If you're going to do a Die Hard ripoff, Die Hard on a Bus is probably the best version of that.
Yeah. And so when Die Hard with Vengeance came out, I didn't immediately rush out to see it, but then I discovered it on video, and I think everything about this film is fantastic. I think John McTiernan coming back does a great job. I love the way they set it in New York. New York suits John McClane way more than LA. I get the whole idea that he was a fish out of water, whatever. But let's see John McClane in New York, like just that Jersey accent. And, you know, the way they introduce him is so cool. In the back of the truck, he's got a hangover, chewing aspirin in the wife beater. It's like, oh, fuck. And it's interesting because it feels like the mistake they've made with the Die Hard films, obviously, as they've gone on, is he's gotten more and more invincible. Whereas I reckon in the third one, they completely understood what they had to do. And they went back. They not only made him like an ordinary man, they made him a fucked up ordinary man whose marriage is over. He's been kicked off the force. He's got a drinking problem. So it just really hooked into everything that was great about the John McClane mythology. There's so much stuff in the film that is, it's cheesy 90s action, but it's done in the chase through the car chase through Central Park, where he's driving the car through Central Park. Just beautiful Blues Brothers-esque, you know, car stunt. Just amazing. I love Jeremy Irons coming in and just hamming it up as Alan Rickman's brother, you know. I love Samuel L. Jackson. I love the interplay between those two characters. But I especially love the fact that they have these little children's games, like Simon says, because I'm fucking terrible at like thrillers and stuff. But I felt like, oh, I could maybe solve this.
Well, I was about to say, when you mentioned Die Hard with a Vengeance, I was going, can you solve the gallon jug thing?
Use the gallon jug thing to this day when I'm like cooking and stuff. I will get two jugs and pour four out of one and let it leaves two in the other.
Oh, you've worked out the way to do it, because every time I watch it, I'm like, how are they doing this again? Wait, what? Because I just don't have a head for math. So, like, yeah, they might have to break out my my disc of Die Hard with a Vengeance. Watch that again this afternoon.
It's really good. The opening scene is that with the explosion, it's like Hot Town, Summer in the City. It's just all those shots of Brooklyn. And it's just like, I don't know. It almost has like a 70s quality. It's like they souped up a kind of French Connection to give it that 90s gloss. And I think that, like, John McTiernan is another one of those directors like Wes Craven, you know, like Abel Ferrara, who clearly is a super intelligent dude. And there seems to be more of a deconstruction, or not a deconstruction, but he's making more of a comment, you know, in the way he makes his films. And I think this feels like a very New York film. It has like the cynicism of a New York, like even the way that, you know, that Jeremy Irons, you know, he's doesn't really care about Alan Rickman. All of it's a front. Like, none of this shit matters. Yeah. And I feel like that's sort of woven into how the stunts get more and more ridiculous. But they never really screw the pooch. Even the yippee-ki-yay motherfucker moment, I'm like, yeah, like, you've earned it. Like, I feel like in the second one they didn't quite earn it. But this one, I'm like, yeah, bring it back. Bring it back.
But, yeah, no, I just love McTiernan as an action director, because I think it takes a real specific skill set to be able to handle something with that many moving parts and make it all not just thrilling but coherent. Yeah. You know, it'd be very easy to be like, okay, so we're looking at it from this angle now, or maybe that angle, and having it all spliced together. But having it so you know exactly where these characters are, what they're doing at any given time, and then on top of that, just add a lot of personality and a lot of character. I mean, don't neglect the humanity of it.
Yeah.
McTiernan in his best movies does that so, so well, whether it's the first Die Hard or Hunt for Red October, even Predator's got that.
Yeah. Do you reckon in today's current climate you could get away with that sandwich board scene at the start of Vengeance?
I don't think you could.
John McClane's wearing I hate N-words.
Yeah, which is, I think for TV they did a bit of Photoshop and now it's I hate everybody. It's like... I don't know if that's going to work quite as well in Harlem. I don't think it's going to, you know, fire up things quite as much. But, I think that would be one of the first notes that that McTiernan would get. It's like, we're going to have to work something else out here, which is a shame, because it really creates stakes, doesn't it?
Danger. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, no, McTiernan's a great director, and yeah, Die Hard with a Vengeance is a fantastic choice.
Great director. Doesn't sound like such a great bloke. Didn't he, was he spying on his ex or something like that? He went to jail.
Something along those lines. I mean, he actually did time.
Yeah. He's come out with a brand new film, Die Hard 7. John McClane goes to prison. Okay, what is your next film?
My next film is called Tough Turf.
Now I'm fascinated. I really want to hear you explaining to me what Tuff Def is, because I could only find the trailer. Again, a lot of the selections you sent me, I could not find them anywhere online. But I did watch the trailer for this, and I could – here's my impression. It's a mid-80s James Spader, featherhead James Spader, who appears to be like the cool guy at his school. But is there like a – or the bad boy? And is there like a musical number at some point, or is it all a musical? I couldn't quite tell.
It is a weird movie.
Okay, great.
There's no two ways about that. Spader is the lead. The movie is basically a Rebel Without a Cause knockoff. James Spader is in high school, although, again, as per 80s, he looks way too old to be in high school. He and his parents have moved from the East Coast after his family business has gone bust or whatever. They have to move to the wrong side of town.
Yeah.
He's in this very grungy kind of public school.
But he's a snobby dude? So he's come from money?
So he sort of carries himself like a bit of a blue blood, although he's not a snob or anything like that. He's not saying, oh, I wish I wasn't here. Mm. You know, do you have any great Poupon? No, he's not doing any of that business, but he doesn't really fit in, mainly because he runs afoul of the toughest gang in school, aka the Tuffs, T-U-F-F-S. I'm sorry, it's not exactly Jets or Sharks, but falls for the girlfriend of the gang leader,
right,
and subsequently tries to, you know, put the moves on her. The gang leader doesn't like this. Things get more and more, things escalate more and more until a grand fist fight at the old warehouse. But again, it's got these musical numbers in there, like song and dance numbers, like something out of West Side Story. Got a scene where Spader and his pals crash the country club in Beverly Hills. Spader gets on the piano and lip syncs some dreadful Kenny Loggins-esque ballad to the girl that he loves. For some reason, look, it's not a good movie, but for some reason just got its hooks into me. Mm. And I would rent it maybe once a month.
Wow.
Every month for like 3 years. Just because I was really taken with Spader. This was my first experience with Spader. Like,
I imagine that you were you blonde when you were younger?
I had light blonde hair before it all fell out.
I imagine you were I could see you as a young James Spader. Did you feather your hair?
I did when I had it, yeah. but here he is sort of peddling around town on his 10 speed.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have a car.
Yeah.
But he's singing Bebopalula all the time when he's riding his bike. And I thought, this guy's the coolest guy on the planet. I think I might be doing that when I'm riding around Geelong on my push bike. So that began my enduring affection for James Spader, whether it's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Crash. I think I only made it 4 seasons into The Blacklist before I realized this isn't going anywhere. So called it quits on that. But Tuff Turf was one that I watched a lot. And Spader wasn't the only star to come out of it, because playing his little buddy, who's sort of his second Madonna, won Robert Downey Jr.
Ultron and Iron Man met in the early 80s.
And the weirdest thing is there's a scene where those two guys are coming out of some gig, some warehouse gig or whatever. You see them in the same frame, but graffiti on the wall behind them, someone has written "The New Avengers."
Oh, wow.
This is like back in 1985. It's
like, time travel is real.
So, Tuff Turf, as with a lot of my selections, I don't know if I can wholly recommend it, but yeah. There's someone out there who will really, really enjoy it, I know.
Well,
if only for the 80s trappings, because it's 100% 80s.
I also spoke to my wife about doing this show today, and I was sort of running her through the films that we're going to talk about. And we got onto James Spader because it's like a guy recommended this film, and I said I couldn't find online. I watched the trailer. I said I couldn't make head nor tail of it. But James Spader was like, it's peak Spader, sort of like mid to late 80s Spader. And she's like, oh, do you think it is like the greatest curse that the man who had the best hair in the 80s ended up being bald? And I was like, I've never thought of that. I wonder if that does bother James Spader. I wonder if he ever wrestled with the idea of like, going Al Pacino route and getting a wig or plugs or something. Because he did Al Pacino has a wig.
Yeah. Oh, he had fantastic hair. But I remember reading some interview with Spader back in the day. It might have been in GQ about the time of Sex, Lies, and Videotape and all that. Mm. And he was talking about how he didn't really see himself as a leading man. He viewed himself as a character actor. I think he name-checked like Charles Laughton or something. I thought that's a really interesting comparison to make. So honestly, I think he's kind of welcoming the fact that, you know, well, if you want me with hair, then I'll throw some on.
Yeah, right.
But otherwise, no, it's receded. Do what you want. I'm James Spader, bitch.
And he is that. He does have that kind of he is the icing on the cake. You know, it was a bit like Philip Seymour Hoffman. I don't know necessarily I'd watch an entire film with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Give him five great scenes, and it's, you know, perfect.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Spader's in Lincoln, Steven Spielberg's Lincoln,
which
I think is a really, really good movie, but it's got just an absolutely stacked cast. And I think it's Spader, John Hawkes.
He's great.
Yeah, Tim Blake Nelson play these three guys who are kind of like political operatives. They're like spin doctors, but in Lincoln's era. and they're going around and, you know, glad-handing various people and greasing a lot of wheels and sort of, you know, slipping, you know, pound notes into people's palms or whatever. And they're just this... I was like, can we see a whole movie about these guys? I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is fantastic as Lincoln, but these guys are just, you know, keeping the political wheels moving with all manner of, you know, treachery and deceit. It's marvelous. So, yeah.
Well, I guess my next film is also one that I feel weird about recommending to people, because even the name is enough to put people off. And it put me off when I was in the video store because I would see it. It's Orgasmo. It is Trey Parker and Matt Stone's Orgasmo, which I believe they made just before South Park exploded or round about the time. There wasn't a huge window between Orgasmo and South Park. So the premise is a Mormon is spreading the good word and visits a set of a porno. And because he and his girlfriend need money to buy a house, he becomes a star of this porno, playing a porn character called Orgasmo, who has the ability to give people orgasms with some like device that he wears on his arm. And then in a weird bit of meta reality, Orgasmo, the character becomes real. So they go out into the guy plays his sidekick. It tells him that he's developed the technology for real. So they go out into the real world with the Orgasmo ray and start giving people orgasms. And then he becomes Orgasmo for real. Now, that even telling that plot summary, it sounds terrible and I wouldn't want to film, but it is so great. Like, it starts off with a kind of 80s ballad, like an Eye of the Tiger ballad, but by Matt Parker and Trey Stone and Matt Parker, called Now You're a Man, which is the perfect spoof of all those kind of 80s.
I love it so much, that song. And they've used it in South Park maybe once or twice as well. It's so fantastic. But the thing you've got to understand about Parker and Stone is that they're real musical theatre geeks, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. And the film is just packed with all these little moments. Like, obviously the porn stuff, the humour, you can guess where the jokes are, and that's great. And they actually do a really good job. But it's just these little elements, like when Trey Parker arrives at the porno house, security try and tell him to fuck off, and he gets into a fight with them. And out of nowhere, he pulls out like this amazing martial arts moves. And it's not a stuntman. It's Trey Parker doing like cyclone kicks and all this kind of shit. And I had to like Google it. And so he's like a black belt in Taekwondo. And it's just, holy fuck, like that anarchist, that nerdy anarchist from South Park is actually a black belt in Taekwondo. And so he does all these fight scenes in the film and it doesn't make any sense. And then there's just these brilliant little character actors and moments. It, you can sort of see the genesis of South Park in it, that nothing is taken seriously. It really skates the edge of good taste, but it is so rewatchable and so quotable.
It definitely skirts the bounds of good taste, but it also has a good heart, which is odd. Yeah, that's the last thing you expect. But at the same time, this incredibly vulgar, button-pushing sense of humor. I mean, Matt Stone's character's recurring gag about, you know, I don't think it would fly today, but, you know, I don't want to sound gay or nothing. But he's liking all these various things. Like, I don't want to sound gay or nothing, but I think unicorns kick ass.
I think I'd really like to have sex with you.
And then it culminates with, don't want to sound gay or nothing, but really like to have sex with you, saying to this dude. So
I love, there's a scene with a porn director where they're setting up a shot and he's talking to his cinematographer and he says, I want you to start in a close-up of the cock, then slowly zoom out. And the cinematographer thinks about it for a moment and goes, genius.
I'm wondering if this was made pre Boogie Nights or post.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Because I'm just reminded of that scene in Boogie Nights where they're looking over the first movie they've made with Marky Mark.
Yeah.
And Ricky Jay, I think, is editing it, and Bert Reynolds is looking over his shoulder. It's like, it's a real movie, Jack. You made it fly. Then you look at it and it's Brock Landers. You know, it's this awful sort of action movie knockoff with hardcore sex scenes. It's like, it's not good at all.
They would be good companion pieces to watch one after the other, because they sail in the same territory, but one is just an out and out kind of like cartoon, and the other one is like, you know, mini Scorsese.
yeah, but you're absolutely right about being behind the counter at the video store and saying, if you're interested in a good comedy, may I recommend Orgasmo? I mean, yes, 3 out of 4 cats are going to sort of look at you strangely.
It was very select company I would show that to. I knew my boys. The boys in the bungalow pulling bongs. I knew this. If I got a film that is going to have you guys in stitches.
Luckily, when South Park came out, you're sort of able to pull that card and say, do you like South Park? Have you heard of South Park?
Yeah, it's by the same
guys. You might enjoy this. But yeah, I think anyone who can sit through those opening credits and just hear, not hear Now You're a Man, and not want to hear the rest, because it's just, that song just absolutely cracks me up. They're so good with those
spoofs,
those parodies.
What's your next film?
My next film is, it's called Fandango. Now, I think I first saw this around 85 or 86. I would have been maybe 17 years old. Starting to get that teenage wanderlust.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, man, living in Geelong, there's not that much to see. You know, it's a big wide world out there and I really want to experience it, but I'm 17. I don't have a license, any of that kind of business. Now, I forget exactly what made me pick up Fandango at the video store. I didn't get a cinema release here. Like a lot of the movies that I really like, you read about them in, you know, you mentioned Premiere magazine earlier or American Rolling Stone or something along those lines. It's like, oh man, that sounds fantastic. Can't wait to see that. And then it bypasses cinemas here and goes direct to video. But I picked it up mainly because it had the Steven Spielberg name on it.
Mm.
Spielberg was kind of at the peak of his powers at this stage and he was bankrolling or just lending his clout to a lot of young filmmakers, particularly guys out of California film schools. And the writer and director of this movie is a guy named Kevin Reynolds. He made a short film called Proof when he was at USC, University of Southern California. I think Spielberg must have seen it. He said, this is good. Let's expand it. Let's turn it into a feature. And it's about five friends at the University of Austin, I believe, in Texas, around 1971. Some of them are thinking about, okay, well, you know, I'm off to Vietnam to do my duty. And some are like, fuck that, man. I think I'm going to skip to Mexico or to Canada. This group of five friends, they've called themselves the Groovers. They decide to go on one last farewell Fandango for the Groovers across Texas, just, you know, piling into someone's car, loading up with beer, driving as fast as they can, and just getting into misadventures. And, you know, along the way, they grow up. They sort of come to terms with, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Am I going to avoid the draft? Am I going to do my duty? What sort of life am I going to live? What kind of person am I going to be? And starts off as very rollicking and freewheeling and gets not sad, but kind of bittersweet near the end because, you know, there's a whole lot of lost loves and broken hearts.
Secrets are revealed.
And clashes between various members of the group and all that. A bit like American Graffiti in some ways, but a little more self-contained. But it's a movie that I really, really, really dig. And also one that you visited at various times in your life and you realize, oh, okay, they were saying this. I didn't get that when I was 17 or even when I was, 23.
Yeah.
When I'm in my 30s, I'm like, oh, that's what they were trying to tell me. Okay.
You know, I have an example of that which really shocked me, which was National Lampoon's Vacation. Where what's the daughter's name?
Audrey.
Audrey's on this is on the seesaw with her cousin, and she says, "I French kiss." And she says, Audrey says, "So what everyone does?" And she goes, "Yeah, but Daddy says I'm the best." And I never understood that until I caught as an adult. I'm like, "Holy fuck! Did they really just say that? Oh my god!"
I think for ages I also saw like Vacation on the modified for TV version,
right?
And I think there's some scene where the cousin gives Audrey like a big shoebox full of weed.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Well, she's wearing sunglasses when she gets into the car because they've been.
That's right. And for ages I never saw it. But yeah, for the rest of the time, she's just absolutely baked.
Yeah, right. Of course.
Well, nerdy little sidebar here. The cousin who says, "I French kiss you, but Daddy says I'm the best at it." That's Jane Krakowski from 30 Rock.
Yeah, that's right. Alan McBeal.
I was so surprised to learn that a bit later on.
Fandango was one of the early leading roles for Kevin Costner. Is that correct?
It was. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if they kept it sort of on the back burner until, because...
He'd had bad luck, Kevin Costner. Like, everyone knows the Big Chill story, that he was the dead guy that everyone is getting together to mourn in the Big Chill, and they cut all his flashback scenes out. And
that's
there's a
right,
great,
yeah.
There's a great Blink and You'll Miss Him extra moment in Night Shift, the Michael
that's
Keaton,
right, yeah.
Henry Winkler film, where the frat boys are partying in the morgue and he's walking behind Michael Keaton going like chug, chug, chug or something like that. It's like, holy fuck, it's Dances with Wolves. He's chasing Batman around.
But you can see that Costner was sort of on the come up at this stage because he had a bit part, not a bit part, but a supporting role in Silverado, where he's really good and quite the scene stealer. I mean, he's the fast drawing, womanizing young punk brother.
Mm.
But I think it wasn't until The Untouchables that everyone went, "Oh, okay, yeah, this guy's the next leading man or whatever." And Fandango was sort of in that pre Untouchables period, but he's about to break through, but not quite yet. But you look at him in this, where he's the alpha male of this group of groovers. He's the one who's sort of instigating the road trip, the partying. He's the one who doesn't want to go to Vietnam, and he's trying to talk his friends out of it.
Right.
And he's it's sort of not peak handsome Costner, but he's just
charismatic.
young and beautiful and incredibly charismatic. He's like, yeah, I would follow this guy just about anywhere. If he's saying... Dodge the draft. Come to Mexico. It's gonna be good.
I really love watching these kind of older films, especially if they're kind of, just garbage where a big star is, because it's so interesting to see that even in a garbage film in which they're completely inexperienced, like the charisma, like Johnny Depp in the first Nightmare on Elm Street is doing fucking nothing. And that's why he's so charismatic. Like, there are so many scenes in that where all the other teenage actors are very earnestly acting like teenagers, talking about the guys trying to kill them in the dreams. And Johnny Depp just doesn't seem to be in the same movie. Like, he's just so lackadaisical. And I've often thought, I wonder if this was direction from Wes Craven, where he's like, so Nancy's telling you, you've got to stay awake and blah, blah, blah. So, you just be really disinterested on the chair and be looking at your belly button, all that kind of stuff. Or if it was just a happy accident where Wes Craven's like, look at this fucking kid. He's so natural. Like, I don't have to tell him to do anything. Like, he's just not even, you've got poor Heather Langenkamp, like, acting her heart out, on the
absolutely,
bed.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's Johnny Depp just being cool as shit.
There's a doco that goes for like 6 hours about the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. And Craven is talking about whether he's going to hire Johnny Depp to be in this movie. And I think his daughter saw a picture of him, and Craven's like, this guy's a bit skinny and he's a bit pale. And Craven's daughter goes, Dad, he's beautiful. So died him. But it's an interesting thing you mentioned about young actors. I mean, you see that in Craven's Scream as well. Everyone's trying to make an impression. They're all working overtime.
Yeah.
And
are you talking about Matthew Lillard? You're talking about Matthew Lillard.
I'm talking about Matthew Lillard, who...
Just tone it down, mate. Just take it to a fucking two, please.
In the years since I always had his performance, and in the years since, this is a young guy trying to make an impression. I'll cut him some slack. And they need to get that out of the system. You see it with any young actor, really. I mean, you see it with Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys. I mean, I think he's pretty good in it, but it's like, that's a lot of energy. Just calm down, dude. And if you calm down, we'll come to you. Mm. You see it with Robert Pattinson as well. I mean, in that movie he did, The Rover, with Guy Pearce. It's like, you're giving us everything, man, but calm down a little bit and we'll come to you. Yeah. And later on he did that. Yeah, so I always find that really, really interesting. But and you see that a bit with Costner as well, because, it's definitely in Silverado he's really playing it up, the sort of the young Jeff Bridges, or cocky, cocksure kind of thing.
Or even Brad Pitt in Thelma and Louise, just that sort
absolutely,
of cocky cowboy.
They realise they've got their shot and they really have to take it. And I don't know, if you're fortunate, people recognise, you're someone I want to watch. You're not quite there yet, but we're going to give you a few more shots because I think you've got it, and eventually they prove it.
Yeah. Well, staying on the theme of coming-of-age stories, my next pick is probably the most critically acclaimed, at least in its genre, and the director certainly is Dazed and Confused, Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused, which, again, I didn't see when it was released in the early 90s, but I discovered it about a couple of years later in the video store. And I love Richard Linklater. I know some people have issues with Boyhood. I just can't. He's engendered such goodwill in me just with his films. I love the pacing of them. I love the way the actors are allowed to just sort of, you know, find their voice in it. And I think it is a genuinely compelling film. I think it's one of the, you know, the best recreations, or at least portrayals, of what it's like to be a teenager. And the fact that they go from freshmen right up to seniors. So you get all of those perspectives on what it's like. And so for people who haven't seen the film, it's basically the last day of school. And so you've got the guys who are moving from their last year of school into their senior year. You've got the freshmen who are having their orientation, and it's set in Texas.
It's 1976, right?
1976. And so there's all this sort of interplay between all these like different groups of teenagers and their concerns. Like, you know, they just want to fit in at the new school, or, you know, the girls getting initiated into the sorority. And then there's this strange initiation for the boys where they get paddled. So the seniors drive around with these fucking wooden bats and grab freshmen and just spank them with these wooden bats. And Ben Affleck plays a particularly sadistic bully who just decides to hone in on this one kid and just wants to beat the shit out of him. And this is pre-leading man Ben Affleck. He's genuinely upsetting. Like he plays a bully so well. And what I love about it is a kind of nostalgic look at the 70s and being a teenager, but it feels quite real. Like all that kind of shit. There's another great scene where Adam Goldberg, there's a big party at the end of the film in the park, and Adam Goldberg is a real nerdy guy. He and his friends they're all nerds, and they've gone to the cool guy's party, and they're just trying to keep their heads down. And he accidentally bumps William Catt, who's a tough guy.
Oh, yeah.
And William Catt challenges him to a fight in front of everyone. And Adam Goldberg gets sideswiped. He's just not prepared for it, and so he sort of skulks away, and then spends the rest of the fucking party feeling shit and going like, "I just need to stand up for myself. I was humiliated." And his friends being like, "Just don't worry about it." And it's so, I identify with that so much, because I was the fucking nerdy dude. I didn't often get picked for fights, but, you know, those instances would happen where you're like, oh, shit, like my masculinity is being threatened. What am I meant to do in this situation? And I just feel like the film has so many of those moments, as well as this, like, you know, really great mid-80s Ferris Bueller, John Hughes type, just fun teen moments of teenagers being teenagers. And I think it has, you know, you say Fandango has a lot of heart, and I think this film does as well. Like, there's just sort of genuine kind of affection for all these teenagers. And I feel like it's just such a great, I don't know if this is the word, assemblage, a compilation of young actors, especially young indie actors who'd gone to do really interesting films.
Oh, yeah. The lineup of actors in this is just incredible. I mean, you mentioned Affleck. This is McConaughey's, I guess, breakout movie. It's probably even his first movie.
Yeah, it was his first film. Yeah. And
the aforementioned Cole Hauser is in there. Renee Zellweger, I think, has a small part in it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people you just recognize and know. Yeah. But one thing I really dig about it is, and I think something that distinguishes it from a lot of teen movies of the 80s and early 90s, is that it's the high school group is not necessarily cut into here are the nerds, here are the jocks. I mean, they have that, but they also all intermingle. The way that high schools normally do. I mean, nerds generally hang out with nerds, but it's not, they don't only hang out with nerds, at least in my experience.
Yeah. And because there's all these interactions with, like, well, I'm dating your sister, and so the little brother can ride with me. And like the Jeremy London, who's playing like kind of the quarterback jock hero guy, is sort of friends with Adam Goldberg. And you're right, it has this kind of very, it's not that kind of simplistic Mean Girls look at high school. It's like, there's definitely tribes. And popular kids will always be popular, and nerds will always be nerds. But that doesn't mean they don't hang out.
It's one big Venn diagram, really. Yeah. You know, there's always going to be a bit of crossover. And everybody wants to hang out with Slater because he's got all the good weed.
Yeah. And the soundtrack is chef's kiss.
The soundtrack is brilliant.
Brilliant soundtrack. And I don't understand how they're able to afford that. Like, I mean, it still would have been an indie film, but, you know, maybe it was just the charm of Richard Linklater. Like, you know, he'd sort of gathered a reputation by that stage of being like the, you know, this sort of cool indie director. Maybe bands were just happy to lend their music.
That's the thing. I mean, he'd done Slacker, I'm wondering if this was his second movie after that. And Slacker was a bit of a cult sensation when it came out in the early 90s.
Yeah, he's a real interesting director, Linklater. Like, even when he's sort of dabbled in more mainstream, like the Newton Boys. Was it Newton Boys? Mm.
Newton Boys, yeah, that Bad News Bears remake he did with Billy Bob Thornton.
School of Rock. School of Rock, I think, is almost perfect. Like, I think it is. There are certain films, whether or not you're into the genre or the subject matter, that you can't argue this is perfectly structured, perfectly cast. Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, a collection of all those events. But for me, it's like Dazed and Confused. I think I'd be interested to show it to teenagers today and see if they have any affection for it, you know, if they can identify with the characters.
I reckon they would. I mean, it does have it doesn't feel inauthentic in its representation of the 70s. I mean, there's a lot of hazing, a lot of bullying, there's a fair bit of sort of casual sexism, that kind of stuff. But not in a punching down kind of fashion. That's more sort of, well, this is the way it was. And Have you seen, they call it a bit of a spiritual sequel, but it's called Everybody Wants Some.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic. I mean,
I love that. I was so taken with it.
I saw it at Sydney Film Festival and everyone I saw it with did not like it, just thought it was really indulgent and stuff. And I'm like, have you not seen Richard Linklater films before? This is
kind of what he does.
This is what he does.
Yeah, he explores masculinity and he's proud of it in some ways, but he's also, look, we fuck up in a lot of ways too, but we've also got some good stuff going for us. And there are a few actors in that are starting to have the breakout that McConaughey had. I mean, I think Wyatt Russell is in it, Kurt Russell's son, who's been in a few things now. A guy called Glenn Powell, who's coming up in the Top Gun sequel, I think is going to be a big star. I love everybody. Everybody wants something. It's fantastic.
Well. What's his name? Tyler
Hoechlin.
Yeah. How do you say that's that? Is it Hoechlin? Is it?
I think it's Hoechlin.
Not Hoechlin. All right. What is your next film?
My next film, we're up to number five, I think.
Oh,
so
okay. Your last film.
We're back to Abel Ferrara Town. We're back to, this is a movie called King of New York. Now, this was released late in 1990. It was part of the gangster and organized crime cinematic wave that we got in the late 1990s, because that year we got Goodfellas, Godfather 3, The Grifters, the Coen brothers' Miller's Crossing. I'm sure there are some others, but also maybe a movie called State of Grace with Sean Penn and Gary Oldman that's about the Irish mob in New York. And this movie, King of New York, directed by Abel Ferrara and starring Christopher Walken as the titular king. He's a gangster named Frank White. Now, first of all, I believe it was Notorious B.I.G. who subsequently referred to himself as the Black Frank White. This movie was huge with African-American audiences because Walken is a star, but I'll tell you, the real star is Lawrence Fishburne as his 2IC, this guy named Jimmy Jump, who's just a two-gun psycho. It's fantastic. But anyway, Frank White has been in jail for a while. He's about to get out, and he decides that he is basically going to take over all of organized crime in New York City and use it to rebuild this hospital for the poor. So he's basically doing dreadful, dreadful stuff because he's killing all his rivals, but he thinks he can sort of buy a bit of redemption by bankrolling this hospital. His fellow criminals don't like this. They go after him. The cops who put him away, Wesley Snipes and David Caruso, absolute dream team. They don't like it either. They want to put him back behind bars. It's just an incredible urban crime thriller. And I'd read about this in this magazine called Film Comment. They did a huge like 3-page article on Abel Ferrara is this great, you know, this is what they're saying, great undiscovered genius. And this is probably his masterpiece to date. And I read this in 1990, like, oh man, I can't wait to see this. Christopher Walken, one of my favorite guys. And it didn't come out on VHS for about another year in Australia. So I'm seeing posters at the Video Store occasionally saying, Roadshow's bringing out King of New York. When? And finally saw it and I'm like, it was worth the wait.
I realized earlier I said that Abel Ferrara directed Desperate Measures. I got it wrong. It was actually Barbet Schroeder directed Desperate Measures. I get those two directors confused.
I was going to make a slight correction as well before, if you don't mind, but it was actually Nicky Catt who was
William Catt, the greatest American hero.
Not William Catt, the greatest American hero. What a departure for William Catt.
That would have been a great scene. I'd love, as long as he's wearing the greatest American hero uniform. Now, I haven't seen King of New York, and again, couldn't find it online, but I did watch a scene. Is there a young Chris Rock in a scene on the subway where he pays off a bunch of kids who are about to rob him?
I don't think it's Chris Rock, but I think it might be Harold Perrineau, who was in Lost.
Oh, yes. Yes, they look the same. Because he looks like a young Chris Rock.
Yeah, like, well, he's rocking the sort of the high-top fade that was very big in the early 90s. Yeah, but I think it's Harold Perrineau.
Oh, right. Yeah,
yeah, but you look through Walken's crew, and I think Giancarlo Esposito is in there.
Wow.
Steve Buscemi is certainly in there. Yeah, they've just assembled this terrific cast of actors, but... Walken is fantastic. This is like pure uncut Walken. Just, you know, he's dancing. He's very sort of he's just completely cold blooded, but at the same time incredibly charismatic.
Yeah.
But Wesley Snipes and particularly David Caruso. I mean, Caruso's got a bad rap and perhaps justifiably so. I don't think anyone likes working with the guy. But you look at him in this, and this is pre NYPD Blue. You go, I'd put money on this guy. I would actually. Oh, yeah. The 90s were so good
to him in cop playing cops, like NYPD Blue aside. Like, think about Mad Dog and Glory. He has
just that one scene with that guy.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Like, that scene alone, you'd bankroll a film. It's like, oh, yeah, I would watch this guy be intimidating, be an angry little redhead to anyone.
It's him. It's this guy Tom Towles, who always played heavies, who's the abusive boyfriend in it. Mm. De Niro,
yeah,
and Caruso's the guy on screen you're looking at, going, "What's he going to do next? Yeah. Holy shit!" Yeah. You know. So
it's pretty amazing.
And he's just as good in King of New York. Wesley Snipes is fantastic, but Fishburne, oh, so incredible. There's a scene where he's gone into this fried chicken shop in Harlem, and he's sort of buying food for all the crew, and he's just intimidating everyone in the place, talking trash about everyone. So, oh man, this is just so marvelous. So if you can get hold of King of New York, I don't know if it's streaming anywhere, which is a damn shame.
I went through your entire list. I think the only one that I could find was funnily enough, Tough Turf. you can rent Tough Turf on YouTube in Australia, but none of the others.
I think all of these are probably available like in physical media. You can buy them on Blu-ray or even 4K. I think they just released a 4K version of King New York, which was probably made for like $5 million. So I don't know how well they're going to enhance it.
All right, my final film is one that TOEFOP listeners would be familiar with, because I actually flew the flag for this a couple episodes ago. We had a listener write in to say, are you guys familiar with the Tremors franchise?
Yes.
Now, I am not familiar with the Tremors franchise, but I am very familiar with Tremors. And again, it was another one of those films where I'm like, what is this fucking cover? Because the cover was this very Muppets-esque looking sandworm coming up like Jaws.
Well, it's the Jaws ripoff, essentially.
Yeah, where you've got Kevin Bacon and
Fred Ward
standing above looking to the ground. And so I was like, I've got to see this film. It is one of the best B-movie films, like modern B-movies, that you'll ever see. And I would also say that if you're going to watch the film, then track down the making of, because the making of where you see like how inventive they were with forced perspective and puppets and miniatures and stuff. It's like filmmaking 101, but it is to do horror comedy is so hard. And these guys just pull it off perfectly. Like it's suspenseful and it's funny and it's absurd. Yeah. And the monsters are genuinely terrifying, and what they can do to you is genuinely terrifying.
They really are. Give us a breakdown of what it's about.
Okay, so it's set in a small town in the, what is it, Arizona desert, some kind of desert somewhere. It's a small town. And Kevin Bacon and his buddy Fred Ward are, I don't know, handyman or something. They work on the land there, and they want to get out because nothing ever happens in this town. They get word that there's a new geologist in town who's been following these strange seismic readings that have been happening in this small town. And so they go to meet her. Suddenly, a farmer goes missing, and they realize that there are these giant sandworms living under this town that respond to vibration, and they will pull you into the ground and kill you. And so
they call them graboids.
Graboids. And they do a trick in it, which is ripped off by the Meg later on, where you think the graboids are about so big, like about the size of a python. Yeah. Then you realize that's just the graboid's tongue. The actual graboid is this Jaws sized sandworm. But it just balances that kind of, when you talk about sort of contained horror or contained genre, like they are in this small town, the rules were established.
Population of about 10.
10, yeah.
Yeah.
And the rules were established very clearly that, you know, they respond to vibration. So then you have this other element of like a quiet place element where you can't make any sound. Mm. And so they have to like pole vault from area to area and get to rooftops. And it's just, it is endlessly entertaining. Like I would often, I say to people, it's a bit like Ghostbusters in the sense that it is this kind of film that marries two different genres together in a way that is at once high stakes but also completely disposable. Like it's just a
They got the levels just right, didn't
just
they?
Right. Yeah, I mean, Ghostbusters is probably more throwaway because you have that kind of Bill Murray element who obviously doesn't give a fuck about what he's doing or what he's saying. All these actors genuinely like commit. But it's just a brilliant, brilliant film just to kind of cheer you up because the action starts straight away and it just doesn't let up.
It really does. And they're just such great company, not just Bacon and Ward, who are, I'm using the term dream team a bit too much, but yeah. I mean, I would put their chemistry up with, say, like Mel Gibson and Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon or anything like that. You get the feeling these two have just lived in each other's pockets for a very, very long time and know each other's flaws and foibles and still just, you know, love each other regardless and have got each other's back. So they're fantastic.
There's a slightly paternal relationship between them because Fred Ward's a little bit older, but at the same that's the other brilliant thing about it is all the characters are sketched so clearly. Like, you know, even Michael Gross and Reba McEntire as the sort of survivalist. Mm. You only need one or two scenes where you get who these guys are. And it's sort of similar to Shaun of the Dead in that way, isn't it? Where you establish the relationship between the two best friends and then that sort of has like an impact on the A storyline. But yeah, absolutely. I haven't seen any of the sequels. Have you dipped into those?
I think I may have seen Tremors 2, : Aftershocks. Bacon didn't come back for that one. I think that was just a solo Fred Ward.
But Fred, I haven't seen any of the other ones.
Pay Fred Ward what he's owed. Come on. The man deserves it. I think they're up to like 7 now. Michael Gross seems to have taken over the lead. I think he's been the name above the title for a fair while now. And they'll occasionally bring in like Jamie Kennedy from Scream or that guy who played Napoleon Dynamite as kind of the offsider.
Oh my God. Well, I did know that they made a pilot with Kevin Bacon for Tremors, which I'm sure, you know, nerdier people than me can track down. But I've always thought that would actually, I could see that. Like, it'd be interesting to see, like, how you'd bring Kevin Bacon back. Like, is he now the grizzled, you know, it's been 30 years, he's a veteran graboid killer, he's seen it all, you know, you bring him back and give him something new. Or I hate that trend at the moment of just fan service where it's like, hey, do you remember that line from the first film? Yeah. Or, you know, we're recreating this bit or that bit. I don't want to see that. But, you know, I'd be interested to see, like, you know, an older Kevin Bacon come back to this.
Well, when I'm being very dorky and rewatching Tremors, as I want to do every 6 months, it's like, oh, what's something new? No, got Tremors right there. Put it on. It's never gonna disappoint.
Yeah.
And last time I was watching, and I'm looking at Fred Ward going, who does he remind me of? Who's around now? And then I realized he's not a dead ringer, but he looks a lot like John Bernthal from,
Yeah. He's got the same kind of broken nose quality.
Yeah. It's sort of that
boxes
blue collar nobility kind of thing going on. Looking at okay, maybe not get Fred Ward back because I think Fred Ward is pushing 80 and I don't want to run around the desert. But how about John Bernthal as Fred Ward's son?
Ah, that's a good cast.
Teaming up with Kevin Bacon and...
What about Frank Grillo? Frank Grillo could be Fred Ward's son.
Oh, Grillo's another very good choice.
Yeah.
He'd be wanting to punch graboids though. God, he's...
very physical man.
A bit of a bruiser, old Frank.
All right. Well, look, so that's our 5 selections. Guy, I'd love to have you back on and we can revisit the video. So this has been a lot of fun. I think we've barely scratched the surface of some films.
I reckon so. Charlie, it's been an absolute blast, man. And thank you so much for inviting me aboard. It was an absolute treat.
Before we go, I know there was a couple of films that we wanted to give shout outs to that we couldn't squeeze in. So we could even potentially talk about these next. But the two films that I couldn't squeeze into today were A Quick Change, one of my favorite heist films, directed by Bill Murray or co-directed by Bill Murray, and California. California, starring Brad Pitt and David Duchovny. Brad Pitt is still my style icon. Like, white trash looks very good on me. Like, open, you know, flannel shirts and trucker hats and beards.
You're not wearing the sleeves today, so.
I've modeled myself, my look. I don't know if that is a good thing, something I should be telling people, but it's definitely had an impact. What are your shout-outs?
Well, look, I mentioned Evil Dead a little early because it was one that was just revisited time and time again during my VHS glory days, to the point where you not just got to know Evil Dead, but the trailer or the movies before it that they had the trailers for.
Oh, yeah.
This really gnarly looking movie called Demented. Where this woman who'd been sexually assaulted by a group of guys, she's back at home trying to recover. Her husband's not being very supportive. One night, a trio of young robbers break in. I don't think they've got any evil intentions towards the woman, but of course she's having terrible flashbacks and she basically just makes mincemeat of them. So it's like, that was probably worse for kids to be watching than Evil Dead. Because, yeah, I mean, Evil Dead is very, very gory, but it's also kind of playful, even though it bills itself as the ultimate experience in grueling horror. But it's also, how are they doing that? That looks fun. Wow, that's bloody. But the trailer for Demented is like, I shouldn't be watching this. No one should be watching this. And another one that I was thinking about those teen TNA comedies that we used to really dig prior to the internet. And one of my favorites is Hot Dog the Movie, which has nothing to do with hot dogs. It's actually to do with downhill skiing, but it's basically a TNA comedy set on the ski slopes, slobs versus slobs kind of deal. Yeah, you get a few topless ladies, a bit of partying, and the bad guys are defeated at the end by the good guys. Sorry for spoilers, but hey, that's the way it goes down.
Well, we can get it. We can put some sauce on Hot Dog the Movie and we can get into Evil Dead.
Some mustard.
Quick Change and California when we have you back on. But for now, I'm Charlie Clausen.
I am Guy Davis.